Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in one year flat. Today's chapter is a long one, so I'm going to go straight in with the reading, and that will be followed by the discussion. This is Book 1, Chapter 25 of Leo Tolstoy's War and Peace. At Bald Hills, Prince Nicholas Andreevich Bolkonsky's estate, the arrival of young Prince Andrew and his wife was daily expected, but this expectation did not upset the regular routine of life in the old prince's household. General-in-Chief Prince Nicholas Andreevich, nicknamed in society the King of Prussia, ever since the Emperor Paul had exiled him to his country estate, had lived there continuously with his daughter, Prince Mary, and her companion, Mademoiselle Bourienne. Though in the new reign he was free to return to the capitals, he still continued to live in the country, remarking that anyone who wanted to see him could come the 100 miles from Moscow to Bald Hills, while he himself needed no one and nothing. He used to say that there are only two sources of human vice, idleness and superstition, and only two virtues, activity and intelligence. He himself undertook his daughter's education, and to develop these two cardinal virtues in her, gave her lessons in algebra and geometry till she was 20, and arranged her life so that her whole time was occupied. He was himself always occupied, writing his memoirs, solving problems in higher mathematics, turning snuff boxes on a lathe, working in the garden, or superintending the building that was always going on at his estate. As regularity is a prime condition facilitating activity, regularity in his household was carried to the highest point of exactitude. He always came to the table under precisely the same conditions, and not only at the same hour, but at the same minute. With those about him, from his daughter to his serfs, the prince was sharp and invariably exacting, so that without being a hard-hearted man, he inspired such fear and respect as few hard-hearted men would have aroused. Although he was in retirement and had now no influence in political affairs, every high official appointed to the province in which the prince's estate lay considered it his duty to visit him, and waited in the lofty antechamber, just as the architect, gardener, or Princess Mary did, till the prince appeared punctually to the appointed hour. Everyone sitting in the antechamber experienced the same feeling of respect and even fear when the enormously high study door opened and showed the figure of a rather small old man with powdered wig, small withered hands and bushy grey eyebrows which, when he frowned, sometimes hid the gleam of his shrewd, youthful, glittering eyes. On the morning of the day that the young couple were to arrive, Princess Mary entered the antechamber, as usual, at the time appointed for the morning greeting, crossing herself with trepidation and repeating a silent prayer. Every morning she came in like that, and every morning she prayed that the daily interview might pass off well. An old, powdered manservant who was sitting in the antechamber rose quietly and said in a whisper, "Please walk in." Through the door came the regular hum of a lathe. The princess timidly opened the door, which moved noiselessly and easily. She paused at the entrance. The prince was working at the lathe, and, after glancing around, continued his work. The enormous study was full of things evidently in constant use. The large table, covered with books and plans, the tall glass-fronted bookcase with keys in the locks, the high desk for writing while standing up, on which lay an open exercise book, and the lathe, with tools laid ready to hand and shavings scattered all around, all indicated continuous, varied, and orderly activity. The motion of a small foot shod in a tartar boot embroidered with silver and the firm pressure of the lean, sinewy hand showed that the prince still possessed the tenacious endurance and vigour of hardy old age. After a few more turns of the lathe, he removed his foot from the pedal, wiped his chisel, dropped it into a leather pouch attached to the lathe, and approaching the table, summoned his daughter. He never gave his children a blessing, so he simply held out his bristly cheek, as yet unshaven, and, regarding her tenderly and attentively, said severely, "Quite well? All right then, sit down." He took the exercise book containing lessons in geometry written by himself and drew up a chair with his foot. "For tomorrow," said he, quickly finding the page and making a scratch from one paragraph to another with his hard nail. The princess bent over the exercise book on the table. "Wait a minute, here's a letter for you," said the old man suddenly, taking a letter addressed in a woman's hand from a bag hanging above the table onto which he threw it. At the sight of the letter, red patches showed themselves on the princess's face. She took it quickly and bent her head over it. "From Heloise?" asked the prince, with a cold smile that showed his still sound yellowish teeth. "Yes, it's from Julie," replied the princess with a timid glance and a timid smile. "I'll let two more letters pass, but the third I'll read," said the prince sternly. "I'm afraid you write much nonsense. I'll read the third." "Read this if you like, father," said the princess, blushing still more and holding out the letter. "The third, I said, the third," cried the prince abruptly, pushing the letter away, and leaning his elbows on the table, he drew towards him the exercise book containing geometrical figures. "Well, madame," he began, stooping over the book close to his daughter and placing an arm on the back of the chair on which she sat so that she felt herself surrounded on all sides by the acrid scent of old age and tobacco which she had known so long. "Now, madame, these triangles are equal. Please note the angle A, B, C." The princess looked in a scared way at her father's eyes glittering close to her. The red patches on her face came and went, and it was plain that she understood nothing and was so frightened that her fear would prevent her understanding any of her father's further explanations, however clear they might be. Whether it was the teacher's fault or the pupil's, this same thing happened every day. The princess's eyes grew dim. She could not see and could not hear anything, but was only conscious of her stern father's withered face close to her, of his breath and the smell of him, and could think only of how to get away quickly to her own room and make out the problem in peace. The old man was beside himself, moved the chair on which he was sitting noisily backwards and forwards, made efforts to control himself and not become vehement, but almost always did become vehement, scolded and sometimes flung the exercise book away. The princess gave a wrong answer. "Well now, isn't she a fool?" shouted the prince, pushing the book aside and turning sharply away, but rising immediately. He paced up and down, lightly touched his daughter's hair and sat down again. He drew up his chair and continued to explain. "This won't do, princess, it won't do," said he, when Princess Mary, having taken and closed the exercise book with the next day's lesson, was about to leave. "Mathematics are most important, madame. I don't want to have you like our silly ladies. Get used to it, and you'll like it," and he patted her cheek. "It will drive all the nonsense out of your head." She turned to go, but he stopped her with a gesture and took an uncut book from the high desk. "Here is some sort of key to the mysteries that your Heloise has sent you. Religious? I don't interfere with anyone's belief. I have looked at it. Take it. Well, now go. Go." He patted her on the shoulder and himself closed the door after her. Princess Mary went back to her room with the sad, scared expression that rarely left her, and which made her plain, sickly face yet plainer. She sat down at her writing table, on which stood miniature portraits and which was littered with books and papers. The princess was as untidy as her father was tidy. She put down the geometry book and eagerly broke the seal of the letter. It was from her most intimate friend from childhood, the same Julie Kuragin who had been at the Rostovs' name day party. Julie wrote in French, "Dear and precious friend, how terrible and frightful a thing is separation. Though I tell myself that half my life and half my happiness are wrapped up in you, and that in spite of the distance separating us, our hearts are united by indissoluble bonds, my heart rebels against fate, and in spite of the pleasures and distractions around me, I cannot overcome a certain secret sorrow that has been in my heart ever since we parted. Why are we not together as we were last summer in your big study on the blue sofa, the confidential sofa? Why cannot I now, as 3 months ago, draw fresh moral strength from your look, so gentle, calm, and penetrating, a look I loved so well and seemed to see before me as I write?" Having read thus far, Princess Mary sighed and glanced into the mirror which stood on her right. It reflected a weak, ungraceful figure and a thin face. Her eyes, always sad, now looked with particular hopelessness at her reflection in the glass. "She flatters me," thought the princess, turning away and continuing to read. But Julie did not flatter her friend. The princess's eyes, large, deep, and luminous, it seemed at times there radiated from them shafts of warm light, were so beautiful that very often, in spite of the plainness of her face, they gave her an attraction more powerful than that of beauty. But the princess never saw the beautiful expression of her own eyes, the look they had when she was not thinking of herself. As with everyone, her face assumed a forced, unnatural expression as soon as she looked in a glass. She went on reading. "All Moscow talks of nothing but war. One of my two brothers is already abroad. The other one with the guards, who are starting on their march to the frontier. Our dear emperor has left Petersburg, and it is thought intends to expose his precious person to the chances of war. God grant that the Corsican monster who is destroying the peace of Europe may be overthrown by the angel whom it has pleased the Almighty in his goodness to give us a sovereign. To say nothing of my brothers, this war has deprived me of one of the associations nearest my heart, I mean young Nicholas Rostov, who with his enthusiasm could not bear to remain inactive and has left the university to join the army. I will confess to you, dear Mary, that in spite of his extreme youth, his departure for the army was a great grief to me. This young man of whom I spoke to you last summer is so noble-minded and full of that real youthfulness which one seldom finds nowadays among our old men of 20, and particularly he is so frank, he has so much heart, he is so pure and poetic, that my relations with him, transient as they were, have been one of the sweetest comforts to my poor heart, which has already suffered so much. Some day I will tell you about our parting, and all that was said then, that is still so fresh. Ah, dear friend, you are happy not to know those poignant joys and sorrows. You are fortunate, for the latter are generally the stronger. I know very well that Count Nicholas is too young ever to be more to me than a friend, but this sweet friendship, this poetic and pure intimacy, were what my heart needed. But enough of this. The chief news about which all Moscow gossips is the death of old Count Bezukhov and his inheritance. Fancy, the three princesses have received very little, Prince Vasily nothing, and it is Monsieur Pierre who has inherited all the property and has besides been recognized as legitimate, so that he is now Count Bezukhov and possessor of the finest fortune in Russia. It is rumored that Prince Vasily played a very despicable part in this affair, and that he returns to Petersburg quite crestfallen. I confess I understand very little about these matters of wills and inheritance, but I do know that since this young man, whom we all used to know as plain Monsieur Pierre, has become Count Bezukhov and the owner of one of the largest fortunes in Russia, I am much amused to watch the change in the tone and manners of the mamas burdened by marriageable daughters, and of the young ladies themselves towards him, though between you and me, he always seemed to me a poor sort of fellow. As for the past 2 years, people have amused themselves by finding husbands for me, most of whom I don't even know. The matchmaking chronicles of Moscow now speak of me as the future Countess Bezukhova. But you will understand that I have no desire for the post. A propos, me under the seal of strict secrecy, of a plan of marriage for you, it is neither more nor less than the Prince Vasily's son Anatole, whom they wish to reform by marrying him to someone rich and distingué, and it is on you that his relations' choice has fallen. I don't know what you will think of it, but I consider it my duty to let you know of it. He is said to be very handsome, and a terrible scapegrace. That is all I have been able to find out about him. But enough of gossip. I am at the end of my second sheet of paper, and Mama has sent for me to go and dine at the Apraxins. Read the mystical book I am sending you. It has an enormous success here, though there are things in it difficult for the feeble human mind to grasp. It is an admirable book which calms and elevates the soul. Adieu. Give my respect to Monsieur, your father, and my compliments to Mademoiselle Bourienne. I embrace you as I love you. Julie. P.S. Let me have news of your brother and his charming little wife. The princess pondered a while, with a thoughtful smile and her luminous eyes lit up so that her face was entirely transformed. Then she suddenly rose and, with her heavy tread, went up to the table. She took a sheet of paper and her hand moved rapidly over it. This is the reply she wrote, also in French. Dear and precious friend, your letter of the 13th has given me great delight. So you still love me, my romantic Julie. Separation, of which you say so much that is bad, does not seem to have had its usual effect on you. You complain of our separation. What then should I say, if I dared complain? I, who am deprived of all who are dear to me? Ah, if we had not religion to console us, life would be very sad. Why do you suppose that I should look severely on your affection for that young man? On such matters I am only severe with myself. I understand such feelings in others, and if never having felt them, I cannot approve of them, neither do I condemn them. Only it seems to me that Christian love, love of one's neighbour, love of one's enemy, is worthier, sweeter, and better than the feelings which the beautiful eyes of a young man can inspire in a romantic and loving young girl like yourself. The news of Count Bezukhov's death reached us before your letter, and my father was much affected by it. He says the Count was the last representative, but one of the great century, and that it is his own turn now, but that he will do all he can to let his turn come as late as possible. God preserve us from that terrible misfortune. I cannot agree with you more about Pierre, whom I knew as a child. He always seemed to me to have an excellent heart, and that is the quality I value most in people. As to his inheritance and the part played by Prince Vasily, it is very sad for both. Ah, my dear friend, our divine Saviour's words, that it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God, are terribly true. I pity Prince Vasily, but am still more sorry for Pierre, so young and burdened with such riches. To what temptations he will be exposed. If I were asked what I desire most on earth, it would be to be poorer than the poorest beggar. 1,000 thanks, dear friend, for the volume you have sent me, and which has such a success in Moscow. Yet, since you tell me that among some good things it contains others which our weak human understanding cannot grasp, it seems to me rather useless to spend time reading what is unintelligible and can therefore bear no fruit. I never could understand the fondness some people have for confusing their minds by dwelling on mystical books that merely awaken their doubts and excite their imagination, giving them a bent for exaggeration quite contrary to Christian simplicity. Let us rather read the epistles and the gospels. Let us not seek to penetrate what mysteries they contain, for how can we, miserable sinners that we are, know the terrible and holy secrets of providence while we remain in this flesh which forms an impenetrable veil between us and the eternal? Let us rather confine ourselves to studying those sublime rules which our divine Saviour has left for our guidance here below. Let us try to conform to them and follow them, and let us be persuaded that the less we let our feeble human minds roam, the better we shall please God, who rejects all knowledge that does not come from Him, and the less we seek to fathom what He has been pleased to conceal from us, the sooner will He vouchsafe its revelation to us through His divine Spirit. My father has not spoken to me of a suitor, but has only told me that he has received a letter and is expecting a visit from Prince Vasily. In regard to this project of marriage for me, I will tell you, dear sweet friend, that I look on marriage as a divine institution to which we must conform. However painful it may be to me, shall the Almighty ever lay the duties of wife and mother upon me, I shall try to perform them as faithfully as I can, without disquieting myself by examining my feelings towards him whom he may give me for husband. I have had a letter from my brother, who announces his speedy arrival at Bald Hills with his wife. This pleasure will be but a brief one, however, for he will leave us again to take part in this unhappy war into which we have been drawn, God knows how or why. Not only where you are, at the heart of affairs and of the world, is the talk all of war. Even here, amid field work and the calm of nature, which townsfolk consider the characteristic of the country, rumours of war are heard and painfully felt. My father talks of nothing but marches and countermarches, things of which I understand nothing, and the day before yesterday, during my daily walk through the village, I witnessed a heart-rending scene. It was a convoy of conscripts enrolled from our people and starting to join the army. You should have seen the state of the mothers, wives, and children of the men who were going, and should have heard the sobs. It seems as though mankind has forgotten the laws of its divine Saviour, who preached love and forgiveness of injuries, and that men attribute the greatest merit to skill in killing one another. Adieu, dear and kind friend. May our divine Saviour and his most holy mothers keep you in their holy and all-powerful care. Mary. Ah, you are sending off a letter, Princess. I have already dispatched mine. I have written to my poor mother, said the smiling Mademoiselle Bourienne, rapidly, in her pleasant, mellow tones and with guttural ahs. She brought the Princess Mary's strenuous, mournful and gloomy world a quite different atmosphere, careless, light-hearted, and self-satisfied. Princess, I must warn you, she added, lowering her voice and evidently listening to herself with pleasure and speaking with exaggerated graciament, which the footnotes tells me means the guttural pronunciation of the letter R chiefly affected by Parisians. The prince has been scolding Michael Ivanovic. He is in a very bad humour, very morose. Be prepared. Ah, dear friend, replied Princess Mary, I have asked you never to warn me of the humour my father is in. I do not allow myself to judge him, and would not have others do so. The princess glanced at her watch, and seeing that she was 5 minutes late in starting her practice on the clavichord, went into the sitting room with a look of alarm. Between 12 and 2 o'clock, as the day was mapped out, the prince rested and the princess played the clavichord. All right. Here's the situation, ladies and gentlemen. I am grumpy. And I got to my office and it is like 35 degrees in here. And I can't record with the air conditioner on because it's far too loud. So I'm recording this with no shirt on. Just so you can get a complete mental picture. And to make matters worse, I'm out of coffee. So I haven't had a coffee yet today and it's already midday almost. So I thought, you know what, I should sort this out. I should go get a coffee, for starters. Put the aircon on and clear, and you know, cool down the office and then come back a little later. But I thought, nah, you know what, I'm just going to do it. I'm going to do it grumpy. I'm going to do a grumpy reading today. So here we are. And, you know, I think the criticisms I'll give today, the discussion, I'll probably be quite negative, I'll be honest. But you know what, it's this funny thing with... The reason I kind of decided to go ahead and do it grumpy is A, because I don't have a lot of time. But B, and this might just be me, you know, rationalizing it to myself, but when I'm writing, when I'm working on a novel myself, there's kind of two moods. There's the positive mood where you're like, yes, this is great. I'm loving this. I'm a fantastic writer. Everything I do is great. And then there's sort of every second day when you're like, I am the worst at this. Why am I bothering? What am I? You're your own worst critic, basically. And on those days, you just do not get writing done, you know, or you might, but it's going to be a real struggle. So I tell my students, those days are as productive as the other, as, you know, as the good days. Why? Well, because on those days, you will be the best editor and proofreader possible. You'll be so hard on yourself that you'll pick up every little mistake. And you'll hate everything that you wrote yesterday when you were in that good mood and you were going so strong. So you use those grumpy days as a day to red pen your work. I guess today is an experiment in uncaffeinated podcasting. You'll notice that the reading was sloppy. I'll be the first to admit. You probably even heard me get annoyed mid-sentence at Tolstoy's lack of commas and full stops. Which has been something I've noticed throughout the whole book. It hasn't really annoyed me, but it has kind of stuck out as like, gee, you know, if you just used a few commas and full stops, this would be a lot easier to read. That might be a translation issue. It might not be from the original text. It might be that this particular edition, they've decided to not break up paragraphs into sentences. But today, it was straight up annoying me because my brain wasn't capable of processing the sentences quick enough to know how to read them with the right inflection, so I kept messing them up. There's actually something that... there's a divide between writing for young people and writing for older audiences. And it's a grammatical thing. So a lot of people think grammar is sort of a fixed rule, but it actually isn't. One great example is you use more commas when writing for a younger audience. And that's because a younger reader is less capable of reading ahead. So for example, if you're reading out loud, you actually read a few words ahead of what you're saying, almost in like your peripheral vision. And that informs how you structure the sentence. It tells you where to pause if there's no comma. But a younger reader is less capable of doing that, and so the commas tell them where to pause. Same thing with full stops and other punctuations. Tolstoy is on expert level. It's like he doesn't give you commas, he doesn't give you full stops. Quite often I'll get into a sentence and realize I'm reading it completely wrong. Anyway, today that got me. That got me good today. It's just become apparent to me that my brain basically requires caffeine in order to function at 100%. So, what did I think of this chapter? I was confused. At the end of this chapter, I went straight into the character listings to figure out who we were dealing with here, because I couldn't work it out. I also felt it was a long chapter, which it was. It was about double the length of the usual chapter. I found the letters to be a little bit dry and slow. I really enjoyed the first part of the chapter, the description of this household, even though I didn't really know whose house it was or where we were, who this old man was, who his daughter was. I thought it was pretty well done in terms of quickly giving you a setting, a really vivid setting, one that I could immediately imagine in great detail with just sort of one page into the chapter, one page into this new setting. I felt that the old father and the younger daughter, they played off them as opposites. One is very logical, pragmatic, mathematical. The other was kind of overly spiritual, religious, and simple-minded by her own admission. It was, to me, a little bit almost heavy-handed, you know. There was no subtlety in the writing of these two characters to be an opposite pairing. Had it been one of my own books or one of my own students' works, I probably would have said, gee, that's a little bit heavy-handed. That's a little bit on the nose. Maybe tone down the symbolism there somewhat. But hey, this is a guy sitting in a closet with no t-shirt on, criticizing one of the greatest writers ever, so I should probably bear that in mind as I sit here. All right, so the issue of who were these characters. It was probably just me that was confused, but I'm still going to clarify it as if everyone else is as dumb as me. So after I read the chapter, I went and had a look at the character list to try to figure out who all these people were. And it all makes sense to me now. So it actually kind of goes back to a discussion in chapter one between Anna Pavlovna and Prince Vasily. Prince Vasily complains about how much Anatole, his youngest son, is costing him. That's the same Anatole who had the party with the bear, where Pierre attended and tried to drink rum on a windowsill. So the party animal, Anatole, is costing Prince Vasily too much money. Anna Pavlovna says, why don't you marry him off to Maya Bolkonskaya? This is way back in chapter one. Here's what she says. Have you never thought of marrying your prodigal son, Anatole? She asked. They say old maids have a mania for matchmaking, and though I don't feel that weakness in myself as yet, I know a little person who is very unhappy with her father. She is a relation of yours, Princess Maya Bolkonskaya. Prince Vasily considers it, and he asks, is this princess of yours rich? Anna Pavlovna responds, her father is very rich and stingy. He lives in the country. He is the well-known Prince Bolkonsky. He had to retire from the army under the late emperor and was nicknamed the King of Prussia. He is very clever, but eccentric, and a bore. The poor girl is very unhappy. She has a brother. I think you know him. He married Lisa Minen lately. He is an aide-de-camp of Kutuzov's, and he will be here tonight. That, of course, is Prince Andrei or Prince Andrew. Prince Andrew, don't ever get married, Pierre Bolkonsky. You might remember him begging Pierre not to ever get married. He's the guy that seems so unhappy in his marriage that he went off to war, seemingly just to get away from his wife, Lisa. Lisa complained about how, you know, when he goes to war, she's going to have to go and live all alone in the country. He reminds her, well, my dad and my sister will be there as well. You won't be all alone. So this chapter is that country home. We've met the stingy, old, senior Bolkonski, quite an unhappy old man. And we meet his daughter and Prince Andrew's sister, Mary. Now, I might be mistaken, but I don't think we've met Mary yet. We've only sort of heard of her in passing. I might be wrong. She might have been in one of the scenes. But there you go. It all makes sense to me now. And as it turns out, Princess Mary is friends with Julie Karagin. It really didn't make any sense to be reading this chapter, and I had to go and clarify it all. But now that I've looked into it and figured it all out, it did take me a good 10, 15 minutes to work it out, even looking at the character listings and everything. Once I'd done that, it all makes perfect sense now. And I can certainly see why Andre's wife, Lisa, really doesn't want to go off and live in this country estate. You know, meeting Senior Bolkonski, it does also shed some light on another reason that Andre might be so keen to go off to war. Maybe he doesn't want to be around all that. There was a few complaints about the way in which the contents of the will of Bezukhov's was revealed in this chapter. Reddit user Lowdown said, "The exchange of letters in this chapter bothered me. I felt the revealing of Bezukhov's will was anticlimactic, almost mentioned as an aside. Yet, I can't wait to see what the third letter will contain that Prince Nikolai will surely read." He did seem very adamant that he was going to read the third letter. And I would agree, it seems a literary tool of Tolstoy's to reveal happenings, reveal resolutions and reveal information in a completely detached scene, in another scene, as characters gossiping about or recounting things that have already happened. Reddit user Alco Joe said, "I agree that it was pretty anticlimactic, but it struck me as a bookend to the trouble that Pierre and Anatoly got into in Petersburg, being summed up at the Rostovs by the name day guests. I hope this isn't a sign of things to come with the action happening off screen." MacTavir Tutiana said, "I was kind of disappointed with the Count's will reveal. Not the result from it, but that it was presented through letters between other secondary characters." Another Reddit user, Jeese Kane, said, "I actually quite liked it. I love that we're experiencing events by moving from person to person. It creates a real feeling of dynamism. It ties in with Tolstoy's view of history too, whereby people are carried along on a tide. Finally, I think that by learning of the outcome in a letter, we learn that it is already the subject of gossip. It all just makes the book feel a little bit more alive and busy, in my opinion." Yeah, I can see that point about Tolstoy's view of history. You know, on the very back cover of this book that I'm reading, in the blurb, it says that this book expresses Tolstoy's view that history is an inexorable process which man cannot influence. Maybe I'm thinking now that one way to look at it is by having characters retrospectively discuss the things that happened. It kind of cements the major happenings of the book as immediately part of history. You know, we know immediately that what was revealed in the Count's will was significant enough to be gossip, to be talked about, and I guess to be part of history. Another Reddit user, Who Was Once Delight, said, "I am trying to hold out some sympathy for Mary, but right now I'm really put off by her long-suffering religiosity. Also, is this the home that our poor, downy-lipped, pregnant squirrel princess is being shuffled off to? No wonder she was so mad." Another thread that came up in the A Year of War and Peace subreddit was, and this was tagged with a serious tag, Ninjastro asked, "Is anybody else getting gay vibes from the characters?" And in the thread I can see some mixed comments, but certainly these letters between Mary and Julie seemed a little bit gay. Reddit user Galaxy of Noodles said, "Not gonna lie, I thought the same thing when I read Mary and Julie's letters." Blaskian said, "Me too. With all that apparent sneaking around and missing each other and cryptic references to time spent together on the couch, I got a little bit of that vibe as well reading it, but I must admit, I just thought that's probably how they spoke back then. Maybe that was a normal thing. When you write a letter to someone, you start with this kind of gushing sentimentality to that person, letting them know how much you miss them and all that kind of thing. Libby Stitch said, I must admit, I thought there's something very intimate going on between Mary and Julie. They obviously passionately love each other, and I thought there were hints that it may be more than just platonic. Interesting. Well, I guess time will tell. We'll read on. I'm going to leave this episode there. Thanks very much for listening. I apologize for my grumpiness. I'm going to go put a shirt on now and get myself a cup of coffee. Thank you again for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.